people and concerning APPR. So, very good. I was going to say, I understand we have some logistical issues here, so let's work them out. Who is going to be arguing?
You and I will be arguing for the appellant.
Okay. We would like to be able to, we record all of the arguments, and we'd like to be able to have your argument recorded. I think the best way for us to even have hope of doing that would be if you could place yourself next to the podium, and if we can put the podium as low as possible and move that microphone over to the side. Do you think that would work for you?
I'll have to pull a chair or something over to put my notes on that.
We can do that if it works for you, if it's comfortable for you.
We can make it.
Okay.
If I have to reference materials, it may just take me an extra moment to.
That's fine. That's fine. So, Krista, if you can facilitate that, both by lowering the podium and swinging that over, let's see if it'll work.
And I can check whether your voice is registering over there.
Oh, good. Well, let's test and see if the voice is registering, and if it's not registering, then there's no sense of inconveniencing you.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. So is this registering here?
It is. Okay, and just speak straight to us and try it again.
Okay, is that working there?
Is it registering when she speaks straight at us? Try it again.
Feel like the Verizon person. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. All right, so you don't have to turn your head. We'll count on the microphone to do its job.
Okay, great.
You may proceed.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. I'm Carrie Ann Lucas, and I'm VAR number 36620. I represent the appellant APPR in this matter. Also present with me is my legal assistant, who will help me with timing, since I can't see the clock, and also a sign language interpreter, Sherry Howe, who will be interpreting your questions for me and opposing counsel's argument. Your Honors, the trial court's ruling is erroneous for the following reasons. First, the trial court applied the incorrect standard when ruling that the father abandoned his children when he failed to make regular and meaningful contact with the children, rather than the correct standard, which is that he left the children willfully without an intent to return, and the evidence does not support that standard. The second error by the trial court is that it erred when it failed to find cause for non-payment of child support. And the final reason the trial court erred was when it failed to apply the clear and convincing evidence standard when making its ruling. The trial court failed to apply the correct standard that in the case of abandonment, when determining abandonment in the context of an adoption, and particularly a kinship adoption, is that the trial court needed to find that the father willfully abandoned his children without an intent to return. And neither the evidence in the record supports that, nor does the trial court's ruling actually indicate that the trial court applied that standard. That standard is articulated in the INRI JAV case, which was decided by this court last year, where it said, unless the totality of the circumstances shows that the natural parent has left the child willfully without an intent to return, abandonment cannot be found. Instead, in this case, the trial court applied the standard that the father needed to maintain regular and meaningful contact with the children. And this is a far greater burden than willfully leaving without an intent to return. The father in this case repeatedly tried to reestablish a relationship with his children, and absolutely he was not a model father. We're not challenging that a guardianship needs to exist. He's not asking to have these children removed from their guardians. He's happy with the guardianship situation, but he still is the father to these children and wants to be able to maintain that role. The aunt and uncle in their brief cite a number of instances where the father failed to maintain a relationship with the children. With the exception of one visit, which was the Christmas 2006 visit, with the exception of that one visit, all of the instances cited by the aunt and uncle in their brief were preceded the one-year relevant time period that we look at in determining whether a parent has abandoned their children in the context of adoption. In the petition of RHN case, it's well established that the period, the relevant time period in the context of adoption is the calendar year prior to the adoption petition being filed. And in that calendar year, there was one instance where my client did not see the children when he had an opportunity to, and that was because he was ill with the flu. And that was clear in the record. The remainder of the time, my client made multiple attempts each month, most months, to make contact with his children by telephoning the aunt and uncle, by calling their house, by trying to reach the children. His siblings even brought the children to the nursing home where he was confined for visit. During the entire year before the petition was filed, my client, as I'm sure you all noted, was severely ill and was confined either to a hospital or a nursing home. For the first 2 months, he was in a nursing home, most of that time in a coma, in a hospital, most of the time in a coma. And then when he recovered from the coma, he was then placed in a nursing home where he remained until after the petition was filed.
Let me ask a question if I can. What is the evidence that when he went to the nursing home, he was, as you characterized it, confined there, as opposed to simply residing there and being treated there? In other words, is there any evidence in the record that he couldn't get out for visits or leave and then come back in the evening? What is the evidence in the record on that issue?
At the time my client was there, the record indicated that he had absolutely zero income and no other resources. So the state was paying his bills, and so he had to meet the standard for nursing home level of care at that time in order to be there. While he could leave for therapeutic time, he was not able to establish his own home. And when he certainly left the nursing home at that time. He did not have insurance at the time. That was in the record. And the nursing home certainly would not have kept him there had they not, without it being medically necessary for him to be there, given his lack of insurance and his indigent circumstances at the time. While he was there in the nursing home, he did attempt to maintain a relationship with his children. His brother assisted him by providing him a calling card. He attempted calls. His siblings did bring the elder child in particular for visits to my client in the nursing home. The one visit where he would have been able to leave but for his illness was that Christmas visit in 2006. The second reason why the trial court erred was when it failed to find cause for non-payment of child support. And at this time, if the trial court's ruling stands, it greatly expands the reach of 19-5203. The statute requires that a natural parent must have failed without cause to provide reasonable support for a child for a period of 1 year or more. And again, pursuant to RHN, the relevant time period for determining whether for non-payment of support is that calendar year preceding the filing of the adoption petition. And during that entire time, my client was in the hospital or in a nursing home with no income and no means to acquire any means to work to acquire income. He did apply for Social Security benefits during that time, but it takes a great deal of time to get through the Social Security process. So that was not complete at the time that.
Let me ask a question about the employment issue. Wasn't the evidence from father himself conflicting on that issue? At one point, doesn't he say, He was volunteering, he's doing volunteer work in the nursing home itself. Another time, he says, "I was not able to work." And didn't the trial court make a credibility determination? Didn't the trial court say, "I don't find any credible evidence that he couldn't work while he was in the nursing home"? If that's the case, as an appellate court, aren't we bound by that?
Your Honor, I do not believe that that was the trial court's ruling in the case of working. I believe the trial court made a ruling that he would be able to work once he was out of the nursing home, that the trial court believed that he was able to at least work, if not able to support himself, work to some degree. I don't believe there was a ruling that the trial court ruled that he could actually work while he was in the nursing home. He did testify that he did some volunteer therapeutic work at the gift shop in the nursing home, which is a common type of therapy for people who are trying to leave the nursing home and be able to go on with their lives. But there was no evidence that he could be paid for that type of work or that it was any sort of gainful type of work. There was absolutely no evidence to that effect. I mean, the fact of this case is that he was in the nursing home. I mean, despite even if he was able to leave for visits, which there's no testimony one way or the other regarding that while he was in the nursing home, he still had zero income and no ability to earn income while he was in the hospital or nursing home. He was still medically required to be at the nursing home. Now, the standard, and in order, during that time, frankly, he had absolutely no income. He was completely indigent. He had, paying child support during that time was impossible. And the standard under the Children's Code is quite different from that under the Domestic Relations Code. Under the Domestic Relations Code, we do say all parents have a minimum child support order. The standard in the adoption statutes, however, in 19-5203 is different. The legislature wrote in a clause for there to be cause for failure to pay child support. That does not exist under the family relations statute under Title 14. And that's in part because adoption infringes on a fundamental right. It goes beyond simple financial concerns. So while the court ruled that even people in prison are required to pay child support, I think that's demonstrative of the court's failure to consider what is cause for failure to pay child support. If confinement in a hospital and a nursing home is not cause to pay child support, what is? This father had zero income during this time. And the fact that he did some volunteer work in the nursing home as part of his therapeutic goals is not demonstrative of his ability to work and earn income and be able to support himself and support his children. And this is real distinguishable from the RHN case, for example. In the RHN case, the father was incarcerated, presumably because of an action of the father. People who are incarcerated are there for a reason. They've been adjudicated guilty of a crime and they're incarcerated. In this case, my client got sick. He had an infection that didn't respond to antibiotics, and he was in a coma for over 6 weeks, and then in a nursing home for 10 months. And this is very different than the Carcannon case, where a parent decided to go to medical school and not support the children. This is very distinguishable. That was clearly a choice on the part of the parent. My client didn't choose to get sick and be in a hospital and nursing home. So, finally, I believe the trial court erred by failing to use the reasonable, or I'm sorry, the trial court failed to use the standard clear and convincing evidence in its ruling.
Let me ask a question about that. What evidence is there, other than the fact that the trial court didn't use those words, what evidence is there that the trial court used any other standard? I mean, both parties argued to him that the clear and convincing, or to her, I guess, argued that the clear and convincing standard was the proper standard. So what is it, what indication is there that he used the wrong standard, as opposed to what I understand one of your other arguments is, that the standard wasn't met? But do we have any indication that the trial judge used the wrong standard?
The RGB case requires the trial court to identify the standard that's being used. In the absence of the trial court telling us what standard, we don't know what standard the court used. And given that an adoption and the resulting termination of parental rights infringes on a fundamental right of my client, it's essential that there be the most, a fundamentally fair procedures. And I think that includes that the court needs to identify the standard that they're using, particularly since it is the heightened standard in this case. So it is the clear and convincing evidence standard. And without the court identifying that, we have no way to know what standard the court used.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, if I may. But isn't that clearly the statutory standard? And don't we have to presume that the court followed the statutory law?
Pursuant to the RGB case, that the trial court needs to actually articulate the standard. It's not simply enough to assume that. But in the context of a termination of parental rights, such as an adoption, that the trial court needs to actually articulate the standard.
Are you saying that it's a sort of magic words thing, where the court has to express the words clear and convincing evidence, or else it is flawed?
I think in the absence of a court at least providing some indication in either the written or oral order what standard the court uses, I think we have to have something to know that. I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Hillary.
Would you move the microphone over in your direction now? And if you need to, you can raise the podium.
Hillary Lipton, I appear on behalf of the petitioner appellees in this matter who are present in the court, Your Honor.
And I'll ask you to speak loudly, please.
I'm sorry. I will do my best. Your Honor, if I can address first the last question from Justice Bernard, I would indicate that in the court's ruling, the court indicated directly that the court considered the testimony of all the witnesses, arguments of counsel, and the statutory authority in coming to the conclusions that the court did. So I don't believe that the court needs to make the magic words of clear and convincing evidence so long as the evidence supports the findings that the court made. And I would submit, Your Honor, that Judge Delgado's ruling supports by clear and convincing evidence.
What about the argument that RGB requires a court to articulate the standard of proof?
Your Honor, I believe when we say articulate, I don't necessarily believe that that means stating clear and convincing evidence as much as articulating what supports the statutory requirements.
Do you agree that RGB says that?
Yes.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, I think if we were to go further with this, I believe that Judge Delgado's lack of stating clear and convincing evidence as the evidence in this case is harmless error. It doesn't change what the court heard, what the court based the findings on. I think that what we would be looking at is merely a remand for further findings and allowing Judge Delgado to make that finding or not, but she would have the opportunity to look at the information again. But I believe that based upon the findings that she made, the evidence that she heard, that she did in fact rely on the statutory requirements.
Thank you.
Without going into a lot of detail on this, but there are a lot of dates, I would indicate to the court that the older child, and instead of using initials, I'm going to say older and younger, the older child, at the time that he came to live with his aunt and uncle, he was 7, and the younger child was just slightly over 1 year of age. Today, we have an almost 13-year-old and an almost 6-year-old. So a lot of time has passed through the course of this litigation. Your Honor, the parties began living together based upon permission from the father in April 25th of 05. Guardianship by stipulation was granted in June of 05. There were certain criteria that was met. There was evidence presented to the court that my clients had no intention, and there was not the agreement that they were going to raise these children to emancipation. The agreement was that the respondent father would do certain things in order to work through his grief, his medical issues, anger issues, financial issues, in order to regain the care and custody of his children. The evidence further went on to indicate that he never did any of those things that were required, Your Honor. 1952031J states that the court must find that the parent has abandoned the child for a period of 1 year or more, or have failed without cause to provide reasonable support. Both of those things are not necessary to be found. The court only needs to find one. Ms. Lucas indicated that it's only a 1 year look back, basically, from the time that the petition is filed. So we are looking at basically July 9th of 06 to July 9th of 07 of 2007, Your Honor, where the petition was filed on July 9th. And there is no dispute that in June, I believe, of 06, respondent father was placed into a coma. It was a medical. They put him in a coma because of his sepsis to try to clean it. He was in and out of consciousness for approximately 6 weeks, and then he did transfer to a nursing home. I disagree that the court did not make a credibility finding. If the court were to look at Judge Delgado's ruling, page 9, line 6, the court would find that Judge Delgado found that there was no credible evidence that the father was unable to work. Not no credible evidence that he was unable to work in the future when he got out of the nursing home, but we were dealing with the 1 year look back period of time, and the court found that there was no credible evidence that he was unable to work. I don't believe that this court is able to disturb that finding of credibility that Judge Delgado made.
It's clearly erroneous. I mean, we can disturb it if it's clearly erroneous.
Yes, Your Honor. No, absolutely. I don't believe that that was an erroneous finding by the court. Sorry.
Thank you.
During the time that the respondent father was in the nursing home, he initially testified that he worked in the store that was in the nursing home. Then upon further questioning, it was determined that he volunteered in there, Your Honor, and then it was determined further that he was doing it for therapeutic purposes. What I will tell the court, though, is that there was substantial testimony that even before that, you can look at past behavior as a prediction of future behavior, and the court also found that it was highly unlikely that the father would pay any child support in the future, based on the fact that from the day that the children began residing with the aunt and uncle, he never paid any support for the minor children in any way, shape, or form.
So Ms. Lucas was arguing, though, that the part of that proof is that there has to have been a failure to pay support without cause. And is it your argument that with the Judge Delgado's finding that there's no credible evidence that he could work, thus the issue of no cause is addressed?
That's exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. And I would say that there's other elements to that I will also get into as to why the father did in fact have cause to pay child support. Going back, though, to prior to from when the children began living with my clients, he worked. He worked in a prison. He got fired from working there, but he did in fact work. He got fired for anger issues, which apparently was something that caused him to lose employment throughout his adult life, which was one of the reasons why he was supposed to get into some anger management.
Was he working in the prison as a prisoner?
No, he was working as, actually he didn't specify, I assumed a guard, since he said he got in fights with other guards and inmates.
Thank you.
So during that period of employment, even though it's not the period that we are looking at, he chose not to pay any. There was also further testimony that he had an adult daughter that he never in her entire life supported. Your Honor, when the father filed his response to our petition to terminate, he filed a sworn statement with the court requesting that he not be not have to pay the filing fees associated with his response. In that sworn affidavit, the father indicates that he had $900 per month in income from his family, and that he owned an automobile with the value of $5,000. There was no evidence to dispute that finding, that sworn statement by the respondent father. I think everybody is clear, Your Honor, that there's not, Your Honors, there does not need to be a court order in order for a parent to have an obligation to support. There was no dispute that in this particular case, there was no court order. There was testimony about the respondent father applying for Social Security disability. In fact, the testimony went on to state that it was my client who assisted him with that when he was in and out of his comatose state at the hospital, that she actually assisted him in applying for that. What the testimony further stated during the time of our trial was that there was not a pending they were not waiting for a response. The father had been denied disability at the time of our trial. There was an appeal pending, but at the time of our trial, or the 1 year prior to that we're looking at, he had been denied. So there was absolutely no way to say that in the future when he gets these benefits, he will in fact pay. There was no way to know whether or not he would in fact get the benefits. Your Honor, if we talk about abandonment, I understand the requirement that there needs to be a willful intent and an intent not to return. What I would tell this court is that the definition or the way to look at that is much broader. And yes, did the father make attempts to have contact with his children during that 1 year period of time? Yes. But I think we need to look before that. We need to look at some situations that the father created in order for that relationship to slowly die, to the point where the older child did not want to have a relationship with him, not because of anything my clients did, and this was in the record and in the ruling by the judge, that it was due to the father's behaviors all along. 2 years in a row, father promised, the first year he promised the older child that he would come from Pueblo to this area in order to take his son to school. Didn't show. The next year, he promised he would call him after his first day of school. Didn't call for 2 weeks. On the visits that he did have with the children, he came up here for Thanksgiving. He basically slept and watched TV and was verbally abusive to the older child. When my clients and the children went to Pueblo in order to have a visit, the father watched TV the entire visit, did not interact with the children.
Is that probative of abandonment or dependency and neglect?
I think it's an indication. I think he basically set the groundwork to abandon these children. I think that in order to have a relationship with a child, I think that the parent is required to support and nurture the child, preserve that relationship and work at it. And I think that the father did nothing. If in fact, not only did he do nothing, he actually did things to damage that relationship, which in fact then caused abandonment of that relationship.
Under the statute, if a parent had abandoned a child 2 years earlier and there was no action filed,
and then the parent had returned and cared for the child for a year. Could we reach back that far to the 2 years, 2 years prior of abandonment and apply the statute that way?
No, Your Honor, but I think the difference with that is the parent came back and actually pursued and had a positive relationship if you say that they took care of the child. In this situation, there was so much damage done. There was testimony from a therapist for the older child who was an expert, talked about the trauma of the physical, emotional, and verbal abuse by the father towards the child and how that caused the child to not want to have a relationship.
Well, I mean, even if the father had been in the, even if the child had been in the father's custody and done those things, we couldn't say that the father abandoned the child during the last 12 months because he destroyed the relationship 2 years earlier.
And I don't disagree.
Okay, thank you.
I think we have a question, though, of the intent of the father, and do you get to just kind of stroll in and make the occasional phone call? Is that being a parent? I don't believe that it is. I believe that he has, by virtue of his own actions, abandoned the children. One thing that struck me in preparing this, Your Honor, is when we look at, say, a dependency and neglect, and this is in virtue, we terminated parental rights without going through the other processes. But if a parent were to come back a month after the termination of parental rights and say, but now I completed my treatment plan, they're not given the opportunity to get their children back. What the father is saying, but now I'm going to support my children, and now I'm going to have a relationship with them and nurture that relationship and be a parent, so please don't take this away from me. And I think that is a disservice to the children. Ultimately, we need to be looking at what's in the best interest of these children, and I believe that Judge Delgado's ruling should stand.
Thank you, Ms. Lipton. You started that clock a little soon there, or thanks, you reset it.
Your Honors, I would. Okay. Do we need to test it first?
No, we'll trust it.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just would like to make a few quick points. First of all, regarding the determination of whether my client, regarding Judge Delgado's finding that he was able to work, first of all, I believe that is clearly erroneous, and we identified that in our brief, that my client was receiving at the time of the hearing, and for some months before the hearing, he had begun to receive AND benefits. And that's on page 14 in the reply brief, where the state of Colorado has already adjudicated him as having a total disability, and that precluded him from any type of work. And that was in the evidence at the time of the hearing. I also, regarding the sworn statement that was filed regarding his motion to waive filing fees, that was not entered into evidence at the hearing. And finally, the adoption case is very different from a DNN case, and correctly so. The standard is much stronger in this type of case than a DNN because we don't have the whole process of a treatment plan and reasonable efforts. So I think it's inapplicable to compare this to a DNN process when trying to say a parent could come back. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lucas. And thank you, counsel. Those were excellent arguments, very helpful. This case now stands submitted. We will be issuing an opinion in due course. That completes our docket for today.